Folks, thanks for coming along tonight in this pretty bad weather. It's great to see you here, and welcome to our people on our Zoom call. The one benefit of the pandemic, it has made it possible for our supporters outside of Sydney and interstate to join in our forums here. And tonight it's a special privilege to have John Howard along, as I call him, number 25, Australia's 25th Prime Minister and Australia's second longest serving Prime Minister, just behind, or a few years behind, Sir Robert Menzies, who I think a few of us would say that Sir Robert had a bit of luck with the Labor Party split in the middle of all that, but he still served a very long time, was a very able Prime Minister. So it's great to have John Howard here tonight. Now, he's going to launch Anne's book. Anne's done this book in the Australian Biographical Monograph series published by Connor Court in Brisbane, just called Margaret Guilfoyle, and we're going to, who, of course, as you know, was a prominent Liberal Party senator during the Fraser government. In particular, she's noted for that. So we're going to lead off with John Howard, who was a colleague of Senator Guilfoyle, to launch Anne's book. Then we get some comments from Anne, then we go to questions and discussion. John Howard, we're privileged and you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard and Anne, and it's great to be back at the Sydney Institute. I've been here on a few earlier occasions, and it's a real pleasure to be here tonight to promote, launch this latest contribution to the Australian Biographical Series. And it's about a colleague of mine, Margaret Guilfoyle, with whom I worked very closely, because she was, for a significant period of time that I was Treasurer, she was the Finance Minister. Now, of course, for a long time, there was no such thing as a finance minister in the Australian polity. It was the Treasurer covered the whole range. And it was in, I think, late in the 1970s that Malcolm Fraser split the Treasury and formed a separate Department of Finance. It caused quite a bit of controversy at the time. I don't think the Treasury liked it, because the Treasury was very much in favour of keeping it all together, particularly when it came to the advice flowing to government. But I came to realise in my later years as Treasurer and also as Prime Minister that there was value in having a separate Department of Finance. And I think the skill with which Margaret Guilfoyle administered that speeded me to that conclusion. Margaret had entered Parliament not long before I did. I think she probably entered Parliament as a result of the 1970 half-Senate election, and she therefore took her place in the Senate in 1971, and I was elected at the double dissolution election of 1974. Margaret was very close, as I understood it at the time, to the former Prime Minister John Gorton, and like many, but not all, I stress that, not all Victorian Liberals, she belonged to a loose group that sort of operated on the basis that Malcolm Fraser should never become leader of the Liberal Party. Now, that was not a view, incidentally, that I shared. When I entered Parliament, I came into Parliament with a very positive view of Malcolm Fraser. I thought, amongst other things, he articulated the case for Australia's involvement in Vietnam better than most. I think the only other one, and Gerard sort of alluded to him when he talked about the good fortune of Menzies and the split in the Labor Party. I think after B.A. Santa Maria, Malcolm Fraser articulated the case for our involvement in Vietnam probably better than most. I found Margaret an engaging, disciplined, intelligent woman. She brought to all of the things she did, and my recollection is that in the immediate Fraser government, not the caretaker one, but the immediate one, after the election of the 13th of December 1975, She was given responsibility for Social Security, and she did that extremely well. And then, of course, later on, she became Minister for Finance, and I worked very closely with her. Margaret contributed in a disciplined way to cabinet meetings. She was somebody who didn't carry on about female representation, but she was an exemplar of an intelligent woman. And that is precisely, you know, what one hopes in this sort of blizzard of identity politics in which we now exist. You just want people to contribute as individuals, and they tell the story and they make the point by doing it. If ever anybody made the point for the equality of contributions of men and women to Australian politics, Margaret Guilfoyle did. Now, she, as many of you know, she was born in Belfast, but I think she escaped Belfast before the troubles really arose. And of course, she came to Australia as a very young person and qualified and entered Parliament and made, I think, a great contribution. I thought she balanced the need for being a hard-hearted finance minister with a capacity to say to her then Prime Minister, "Now, Malcolm, it's not a good idea for you to do this, because it will cost you support." And Malcolm would always prick up when the expression "cost you support." Can I tell you, that was a prime ministerial reaction not restricted to Malcolm Fraser. I think I can provide field evidence without match for that. But I found her a wonderful colleague to work with, and I think Anne's done a terrific job. And these monographs are very good because they remind us that the fabric of Australian politics has a whole lot of stories that haven't been told. And to have the benefit of this monograph is absolutely terrific. I kept in touch with Margaret and Stan for years after we all left politics. And I, like so many others, were very sad when she passed away, but she lived a long and very vigorous and a very successful life. And I'm very delighted that Anne has honoured her with this work. And I'm delighted to declare it launched and be very happy to engage in the conversation that will follow. Thank you.
So many thanks to John Hart for a great launch. Anne.
Well, thank you, Prime Minister, and Australia's 25th, as we call him. It was a fine launch and no less deserved of Margaret Guilfoyle and her memory. By the way, to be in this series, you've got to be dead. So if you're looking for the next ones, watch the obituaries. I also should say thank you to Connor Court for publishing the series and for Scott Prasser, who's overseeing it all, and to Jared, who suggested Margaret, since he looked at the series and thought it was lacking any female subjects, which often happens. Well, it was a pleasure to write this. I interviewed Margaret years ago for a book on women in politics, and I'm from Melbourne myself. Her life's been a particular interest to me. And for more than a decade, she stood above many in the world of Australian politics. But it was also a pleasure to write because I believe she'd fallen down the memory hole, as many who are very able in politics do, unless they're the leader or have done something extraordinarily odd, become almost a clown sometimes to get remembered. And Margaret was not, exactly as John Howard spoke of her. She was intelligent, she was efficient, she was able, and she never stood for nonsense. She was not a reformist politician like number 25 PM, like John Howard, and she also didn't seek the top job like Julia Gillard. But she was a politician who fought hard for outcomes, and outcomes are very important, and if you look at the public service, they're often not there very often, a lot. So she worked hard for outcomes, And she had limited options in her favour. And she led in ways that some of our politicians today could learn from. She was acclaimed by many journalists when she entered the Senate in July 1971 as a trailblazer for women. But Margaret Guilfoyle was inclined to reject that sort of tag. She wished simply to be treated as any male MP, any other MP might be, and in her pre-selection for the Senate nomination, when asked how she would manage her children if she got the nomination, she answered in the following way. She said, "I'm asking you to make a decision to give me responsibility to be a representative in the Senate, and I would ask that you would accept that I have the responsibility to make decisions regarding my family." Beryl Beaurepaire, who was one of the pre-selectors, took that on board, and the next bloke that came forward, she asked him how he'd manage, if he got the nomination, how he'd manage his children. Anyway, in spite of the fact that Henry Bolte told Stan Guilfoyle that she didn't have a chance of winning, she did. She won the spot. So they sat at home and that night, and they all sat around the table with the kids who were teenagers and just said, "What are we going to do?" However, they did it. Like Enid Lyons and Ivy Wedgwood before her, Margaret Guilfoyle won her seat in federal parliament against the odds that overwhelmingly favoured men. You hear a lot of fuffle today about women in politics, but believe me, back then it was quite hard. And for all that, as numbers have multiplied for women since then, there are timeless lessons to be learned for both men and women of the career of Margaret Guilfoyle. She was not from a political family. Her father died when she was 10. This was a few years, as John Howard has said, that they immigrated from Belfast back in the 1930s, and they settled in Melbourne's Fairfield. The mother, left as a single parent, reared Margaret and her two siblings on a very modest pension that Margaret never felt they went without. They were encouraged to use, as many were in these times, they were encouraged to use their abilities astutely and make the most of all opportunities. And from this, Margaret Guilfoyle often spoke of the importance of first chance. When it came, it was not to be wasted. Starting work at 15, not being able to afford university fees, and studying accountancy at night school, by age 21, Guilfoyle was a fully qualified and chartered accountant. And that was during the war years when she was able to probably get positions while men were away at the war. The belief in taking up the first chance would stay with her when she became a member of the newly formed Liberal Party of Australia after her marriage to Stan Guilfoyle in November 1952. Stan actually was enrolled in the Liberal Party by his mother, who was a member of the AWNL, and was a friend of Ivy Wedgwood and was very politically conscious, and so he was off flying for the RAAF or whatever. Stan got enrolled in the Liberal Party, care of mum. But they were very strong supporters of the Liberal Party of Australia. They belonged to the South Camberwell branch, where she took leadership positions, and in time roles within the Victorian women's section of the party, which in Victoria is very important. An equal distribution of male and females were to go into all the positions in the party in Victoria, and still do. In 1969 to 70, she was chair of the women's section and on the party state executive, and that took her into standing for pre-selection when Ivy Wedgwood said she would be retiring in 1971. Now, Margaret Guilfoyle believed in loyalty to her community, something she'd learnt from her days in Fairfield as part of the Presbyterian Church with her socially engaged mother. She did not believe in factions and knew what she stood for. And I agree with John, she was a great mate of Gorton, and she probably held a little bit of grudge with Malcolm Fraser, but she never let it show. And she even voted for Malcolm Fraser at times when Andrew Peacock was challenging him. There was something in her DNA that said, be loyal. She did not believe in factions. And Josh Frydenberg summed her up beautifully in his condolence motion in 2020, in November 2020, saying she knew what she believed, but she understood why. So from that I take lesson one. Those who stand as MPs should not only take up opportunities, but they should also know what they stand for and why they do it. And for those who are members of political parties, experience in the party and loyalty to the party is fundamental to success. Margaret Guilfoyle was, to the last, a team player. Okay, we move on. Arriving in the Senate, Margaret Guilford joined just one other female senator, Nancy Butfield from South Australia. It seemed not to worry her. Instead, she set out to make a mark in areas not seen as those relating to women as such. Her husband, Stan, told her as much, suggesting she take opportunities in finance or administration. Her maiden speech tackled the value to Australia of the mining industry, as well as issues of conservation, the environment, and the arts. She joined the Senate Standing Committee on Finance and Government Operations, as well as the Public Accounts Committee. She served on estimates committees and learned to have questions ready from reading reports. She regarded the Senate as an opportunity to develop relationships with members of the crossbenchers, such as senators from the Democratic Labor Party. Now, after serving in the last years of coalition government to December 1972, Guilford gained from the experience of those years in opposition. She was appointed shadow minister responsible for the media in June 1974, and she also served as a valuable team member in the Senate through the days of the 1975 dismissal, and was appointed Minister for Education in the caretaker government of Malcolm Fraser. And she's honourably remembered in dispatched in Paul Kelly's book on the dismissal. It was a time when to be united in the Senate was very important, and there are a couple of senators on the Liberal Party side who weren't so united, and Margaret was one of the ones who kept people together. When Malcolm Fraser formed government in 1975, she accepted, as John Howard has said, the position of Minister for Social Security and became the first woman to hold a cabinet-level portfolio in Australia's federal government. Okay, lesson two from Margaret. Gaining a seat is valuable, but influence is best had at cabinet level. For Margaret Guilford, making it to cabinet was not because of her gender, but from age-old tactics, mastering wide experience and knowledge of policy and practice, alongside of playing with the team. And she did it well. Now, as a minister, as her former colleague Michael Bohm, who was hoping to be here tonight but had trouble on the road, he's described Guilford as no captive of the bureaucracy. But she did work closely with her departmental heads and won their respect. I spoke to a number of former senior bureaucrats to do this monograph, and they couldn't speak highly enough of Margaret Guilford. Andrew Podger, who worked with Guilford as a departmental senior executive, told me she was still his favourite member he ever worked with. I listened to similar affirmations with others, such as Helen Williams, the first woman to hold a deputy secretary position, David Stanton, a former divisional head in Social Security, and Margaret Coleman, former director of the Office of Childcare, who still holds Margaret Guilford in very high regard. And many of these bureaucrats wouldn't have been Liberal collective. They would have had possibly Labor affiliations as well, certainly Martin Reed Coleman, and they still regarded Margaret very highly. And as Minister for Social Security, Guilford was firmly of the view that pension payments and social services should not be part of expenditure cutbacks, something I think that upset her relationship with Philip Lynch a bit in the beginning. Under her watch, universal family allowances replaced child endowment and tax rebates for dependent children, which meant families in the lower income levels benefited much more because the tax rebates benefited people who earned more. She pushed through better funding for women's refuges, automatic indexation of most pensions, and a supporting parents benefit extended to fathers. She was pragmatic about attending to individual requests also from ministers where social needs had been overlooked. Former senior Social Security bureaucrat David Stanton credits Guilford for significant social benefit reform in the Fraser years. Now, many who knew Margaret Guilford, from John Howard to her advisor Rod Kemp, noted her ability with figures and a quickness at absorbing a brief or picking up departmental changes to her instructions. Rod Kemp said to me, various correspondence, whatever would come back from the department, she'd cast her eye over it, and within a quick as a wink, she'd say, they've changed something there, Rod, go and check it out. So she was able to absorb a brief very quickly and pick up anything that was inconsistent. In Senate question time, when answering on behalf of ministers in the House of Representatives, Guilford developed what she termed her postbox answers. She would simply read out the answer given to her in advance by the lower house minister and nothing more, much to the annoyance of the opposition. And during the so-called Greek pensions affair, some of us in the room will remember that, it was her forensic questioning of her somewhat cavalier and heavy-handed departmental head, Patrick Lanigan. You can read about him online from various people's recollections. She deftly fended off opposition attacks, and at no stage did the opposition call for her resignation. So lesson three, always be up to speed with a brief, never leave solutions to departmental officers, and a minister must always be on top of the game. Now, Margaret Guilford would end her time as minister holding the portfolio of finance, as John Howard has explained, it came into operation. She put it that the PM might have thought in 1980, making her the minister for finance, that as the biggest spending minister in the government at Social Security, it was only fair she'd be given the task of pruning the budgets of all the ministers. Now, in this role, Guilford, to the extent that the government didn't last much longer after 1980, Guilford did not succeed. Inflation, lack of budget repair at a time when government debt mattered, and a general malaise about economic stagnation had eaten back Malcolm Fraser's record majority of 1975. And that inability to say it doesn't matter about what people might think, we'll have a go, we'll take a step forward, Malcolm was reaping what he'd sowed. He put reform off. The so-called Razor Gang became what John Howard has since referred to as a damp squib. And despite his efforts for any reform, Malcolm Fraser was not in favour of upsetting voters. And as Guilford found, all ministers at budget time seek increased expenditure. There are no dry ministers, as she put it. So in March 1983, Margaret Guilford found herself, along with her coalition colleagues, back in opposition. Guilford retired in 1987. In time, she'd become an elder statesman of the Liberal Party and increasingly throw her efforts behind promoting women to stand for Parliament. She began to see that as a cause she needed to support. Looking back, she might be best described by former senior bureaucrat Helen Williams, who says, "Where do you start with Margaret? She was a terrific minister. She had this calm confidence that stood her in great stead in very fraught discussions. We kept hearing that her colleagues respected her views and respected the fact she stayed unruffled and got things through." And here I need to add a postscript. As we have watched Senator Concetta Ferranti-Wells hurl her accusations at the party that gave her a 17-year career in the Australian Senate, it's mindful to look back on Margaret Guilford's example when missing a chance for an important spot on a party ticket. In 1993, in spite of her backers, which included Liberal Party Premier Jeff Kennett, who believed she would easily have won the federal presidency of the Liberal Party, she stood aside after pressure from her former leader, Malcolm Fraser. Guilford respected Fraser's presence in the party and would not have wanted an unseemly spat. In the event, Fraser withdrew from the vote at the last minute when he realised he did not have the numbers, and the position went to former Liberal MP Tony Staley. At no stage did Margaret Guilford blame her party or Liberal leaders for what happened. The Liberal Party needs more MPs like Margaret Guilford. Thank you.
Well, many thanks to both John Howard and Anne Henderson. We have copies of Anne's book, Margaret Guilford, and they've been signed by John Howard, who was forced to sit up the front, or volunteered to sit up the front, and sign them all. And they're for sale after the function. And for those who are online on Zoom, they'll be advertised on our website. So now we come to questions and discussion. So I may get Mr. Howard to stand here, Ms. Henderson to stand there. I'll stand over there and away we go. And I'll start with you. You mentioned, or John Howard mentioned, a background in Belfast of a Protestant kind. Margaret Guilford comes to Melbourne. She grows up, I think, in Fairfield, which was then a working-class suburb in Melbourne, and she belongs to the Presbyterian Church, which in Melbourne at the time, the 30s and the 40s, was in parts rather full of, or replete with, anti-Catholic sectarians. But she didn't display any of that. So what was her kind of religious background?
Oh, golly. I don't know that she was very religious at all, in a sense. I mean, I imagine she probably possibly went to church. She got married in the church at Fairfield. There's nothing in Margaret Guilford's history that I have noticed from talking to her, hearing others talk about her, that is in any way sectarian. In fact, she worked for a Japanese company during the war years, before they were forced to close down in the early war years. And she actually made a lot of friends among Japanese in Australia. And she kept a very I suppose, positive view of individual Japanese people at a time when there would have been very anti-Japanese feeling in Australia. I have a feeling that her mother wasn't a sectarian. I know nothing about her father. But from what I've read and what she's told interviews in the library and whatever, there doesn't seem to be any feeling about it. And in the neighbourhood, they played with all the kids. They used to do activities with the Presbyterian Church on Sundays and whatever, but the kids in the neighbourhood all played with one another, whatever their background. She never mentioned it at any stage. So I guess, you know, she came out of it pretty well-rounded.
Now, John Howard, you can't talk for the Presbyterians, but you can for the Methodists. So,
How did you find? Well, I never detected a skerrick of prejudice in her, none whatsoever. But maybe that was, you know, due to the fact that, like Bob Menzies, she was a simple Presbyterian, as he described himself when he granted state aid to Catholic schools. So. But look, it was just never part of her. Being to be in any way bigoted or sectarian, definitely not.
Yeah. And thank you, John, thank you very much. Your final comment, the Liberal Party needs more people like Margaret Guilfoyle. I'd say the whole of the Parliament needs more people like Margaret Guilfoyle.
Is this directed to me?
Both of you. And what I would say after your and all the other and everybody else's knowledge of her, particularly John Howard and Anne's book, her achievements against all competitors, a hell of a lot of men, throughout her whole life, what she stood for, what she worked for, and her achievements, is there any way we could use that as some sort of a example and legacy to try and improve the current antics of Parliament?
Okay. Well, I'm not quite as pessimistic about the quality of the current Parliament on either side. I think we run the danger of overdoing the pessimism. I think we really do. I mean, Margaret did well because she was able, but she also did well because people recognised her ability. And I have to say, I don't ever remember people saying, oh, you know, Malcolm's only done that because she's a woman. I never remember that. I mean, everybody thought she was a capable person and people thought she was promoted on the basis of her ability. She did her work in an effective, efficient, courteous manner, far more effectively and courteously than many of her male colleagues in the government, but no better than many of the others. I think we have overdone the denigration of past dismissiveness towards women in politics. I mean, it was a different society then. And I think we have to recognise that it was just because of the way society was organised, it was harder for women to break through. But they weren't prevented from breaking through if they were able. And Margaret was a wonderful example of it. I mean, and there was another Margaret that was an even greater example of that. And her surname was Roberts.
Oh, I simply would add that I think what's got to in some individuals, and I think we've seen it in the last few months, or we've seen it probably for the last few years, is that some individuals forget why they're there. If you're an independent, okay, you're an independent. But if you're a member of a party, you're only there really because the party chose you. And it seems now, I know that we had Don Chip, we have, you know, there's always been the one who wants to go it alone. But to turn on your party, I don't recall Don Chip turning on the party. You know, if you want to go it alone, go it alone. But to turn on the party that's actually been the reason you got there is to forget why you're there. I know you're there because you're able. I know you're there because you won the nomination and all of that. But you're only there because you won the nomination and you're only there because your colleagues agreed that you should be there. So I just think it's a timely reminder that, you know, you can do very well without trying to be number one spot.
Have I missed anyone? Could I just add to Anne's comment about independence? In my time in the federal parliament, the only really bona fide, and this is my time, independent was Ted Mack. Because Ted Mack had built a local following as the mayor of North Sydney. He presided over the beautiful restoration of North Sydney Oval. He became a state member, and then he ran federal parliament, defeated a person in John Spencer who remains a good personal friend of mine to this day. But Ted Mack was a bona fide. All the others, they got there and said, first place. I mean, Bob Catter, lovable though he is in some ways, but he was a gnat to start off with. That's how he got there. And I mean, I would never have got within a bull's roar of being the member for Bennelong if I hadn't carried a Liberal endorsement.
Andrew.
With an election coming up, what hope is there for independents who do have standards a la Guilfoyle and what John Howden, what you're alluding to?
What hope that they win? I don't know. I think it's very hard in the Australian political system, and John Howard can come after me and work on this, tell you much more about this. I think that it isn't easy to win as independent, although we have those independent... What's the electorate in Northern Victorian? It was a country party.
Indi.
We have got individual electorates that have... We've got now Warringah. But usually... It isn't easy for independents, and it'll be very interesting at this election to see just how well this group of voices of independents do. And even then, they're not really independents. They're working as a kind of ghost party. They're all together in the same batch. They're all being funded by the same group. They're just a sort of independent group. Not really. So I don't think it's easy to do it, but it happens, and it would be good if those that do get to politics as independents do have some of Margaret Guilfoyle's qualities. But Margaret Guilfoyle doesn't have to be that you're an independent or a party person. It's just a question of whether, you know, what Josh Frydenberg said, she knew what she stood for and she knew why. She knew what she wanted to do it, and she did.
I'm hopeful that... publicity given to the independents, who are a group of anti-Liberal candidates. I mean, the biggest test of their authenticity is that not one of them is nominated against a sitting ALP member. And comment I made about independents and their background was I stressed that it was in my time in Parliament. I have to admit that there's a bit of a hybrid with the member for Indi, who appears to have been passed on the seat by the McGowan, the former member. I think that's a slight difference. And Rebecca Sharkey in Mayo is also in a slightly different category. How do I think they will go? I think if the consequences of a minority Labor government dependent on Green support, particularly in the upper house, the consequences of that policy-wise can be pointed out in certain electorates such as Wentworth and there would be, and North Sydney. I think that will be crucial because the nature of Australian politics is that if Albanese ends up in a minority position needing Green support, he will naturally get the support of Bant and Wilkie. I don't know whether he'll get, I doubt that he'll get Bob Catter's support, although, you know, I doubt it very much. As to whether independents, well, all depends on whether they're re-elected. I think Catter will get re-elected. He's got a huge following, and he's still fundamentally seen as a kind of a renegade gnat, but a gnat nonetheless. And I think he will be successful, but they will need the support of the Greens in the Senate. And the Greens will extract their price. They'll extract a price on certain foreign policy issues. And those have been alluded to in the press in recent days, and I think they should continue to be alluded to because they are important considerations, and they'll extract a price on some domestic issues. So I think when those consequences are driven home, and my instincts are that the least likely result of the next election is a comfortable Labor victory. Now, I think it fair to say that the next election is going to be tight, and I think any believer in the Liberal cause who pretends otherwise deluding themselves, but I don't see a pathway to a comfortable Labor victory. So if there is to be an unfortunate result on the fateful day, then it's going to be very narrow, and that means the Greens will be a significant factor. Therefore, the implications for people who are thinking of voting for independence because they see them as disillusioned Liberals should think again.
Thank you, Anne. You probably touched on this in your talk, but just if you could add a bit more. Considering Margaret's background, why did she choose the Liberal Party?
Oh, well, she didn't come from a political family, but she came from a conservative family. And they didn't take any part, or her mother might have taken part, and her father no doubt might have too, had he lived. They didn't join any party or branch in Fairfield because the Liberal or the United Australia Party, as it would have been then, didn't have a branch there. And that's what she said in her interview for the National Library. So I'm assuming from that she became more interested in politics, A, when she met Stan Guilfoyle, and she met him in ninth school, and as he said to me, they took a couple of years to become romantically involved because all he was looking for when he went to talk to Margaret was someone to help him get through his accountancy exams. And she was the only woman in the class, and no doubt he didn't want to tell the blokes he was having trouble with it. He'd come off the back of flying airplanes. And so he went to the female, and they became pals, and then they, you know, after, which is a nice way to become a married couple, they were friends first. But his mother was very politically active. He became a member of the Liberal Party himself, and no doubt, I mean, she didn't talk about it too much, but she became involved with politics with Stan. And then after they married, they lived somewhere over Armidale Well, wherever that way, and the South Camberwell branch was their branch, which when I spoke to, I'm trying to think of her name, Margaret Reed, who was President of the Senate, she spoke about, oh, and their South Camberwell branch, you know, as if that Margaret talked about her South Camberwell branch quite a lot. She just was natural. She had this belief, and it was a bit like Enid Lyons. These women who did so well, so few of them too, but they kind of took challenges. It's like jumping hurdles. That first chance, it was an odd phrase to me, but it makes sense. And the same thing happened with Enid Lyons. They didn't go out to become Prime Minister, or they didn't go out to become MP or any of that. They got into a sort of a pathway where things came to them. Will you do it? Yes, I'll do that. And as they took up the opportunities, they both found themselves where they never dreamed to be. And that certainly happened with Enid Lyons. She was a widow with 11 children alive. And it's 1943, and it was one of the biggest victories that the Labor Party, or it was the biggest victory the Labor Party's ever had. And she won her seat down in Northern Tasmania against two others of her own party. So, you know, she just had a go. And Margaret Guilfoyle did say no. She said, yes, I'll do this. I'll be the secretary, I'll be the president, I'll be the, you know, I'll stand for the state executive. And in doing that, she just built up the experience. And I often think that one of the reasons that's held women in the conservative side of politics or the non-Labor side of politics in Australia back a little bit has been their lack of these bodies. Labor's very bureaucratic, where they can get positions like the unions and all of these other positions in Labor that lead them onto a political path. In the Liberal Party, it's not quite so large a network where you can actually have political positions.
Before we move to the next two questions, one here, one down there, just a quick comment from John Howard, because you wrote the book on Robert Menzies. Now, is the Guilfoyle, Margaret and Stan, that's the kind of group that Menzies appealed to?
Right? Oh, look, he did. And to me, Margaret was a natural Victorian Liberal. She was conservative, but not ultra-conservative. She was ideological, but not zealously so, and I think she had a good sort of balance. I mean, it didn't surprise me in the slightest. And of course, when she entered Parliament, the consensus across the political divide on economic policy was still intact. Everybody in the early 70s believed in centralised wage fixation. Everybody believed in a fixed exchange rate. Nobody in the early 70s was advocating changing the taxation system. And nobody was in...
You tried.
No, early 70s I'm talking about. It predated the Asprey report, which was commissioned by Bill Snedden. And nobody was advocating dismantling tariff protection. So it was a very different world economically, and in many respects you had a consensus on economic policy across the Labor Party and the Liberal Party. It wasn't until really the 80s that the big debate emerged, or the late 70s, the big debate emerged about some of these things, driven by all sorts of pressures.
Karen.
Thank you, Jared. I've just been in the United States the last couple of years, and I've asked this question of numerous politicians and various lobbyists, and they can't tell me. So you two, being very insightful people, will help me. Some of the most conservative societies on earth, England, Australia, New Zealand, and even India, have had female prime ministers. So when I put this question to Americans, why hasn't America ever had a female president? None of them can tell me why. Can you just comment on what you think that says about the difference between America and Australia? America's supposed to be progressive.
You have a go.
You go first.
No. Well, I mean, I really don't. I can't answer that. I can speculate that one of the reasons why it hasn't happened is that the American political party system is very ramshackle when it comes to choosing people for the highest office. I found it extraordinary as somebody who, because of my own political attitudes, would normally want to see a Republican in the White House. I found it astonishing that the Republican Party should have chosen Trump as its candidate in 2016. And I find it even more astonishing that a large part of the Republican Party should contemplate installing him as its candidate for the next election. One of the advantages of a parliamentary system is that you can actually observe the quality of people under the stress of political life before you choose them as a leader. And you see, it's been because all the leaders have all tended to be males in the past. There's a built-in feeling in many political parties, well, you know, you've got to have a man to sort of run the position, which is absurd. And you've mentioned Britain, Australia. The first woman to be a prime minister was Mrs. Bandaranaike in now Sri Lanka. Golda Meir was the second. And then Britain's had two. And we've had one. Isn't it interesting? They've all been parliamentary systems. In one way or another, I mean, the Israeli politics has got a rough and tumble hue to it that doesn't exist elsewhere, but it's nonetheless fundamentally a parliamentary system. So I think there's something in that. I thought it was astonishing that Trump got there, and I'm still staggered that there's such support for him. I thought his behaviour, I mean, this is not your question, but I can't help but say that my elderly behaviour after he lost was appalling. I mean, it's the equivalent of somebody being given out and then the ERS failing, and you know, you should then wander off the field with your bat failing behind you, not still protesting, staying at the crease. Can't do that.
Well, my sixpenny's work is much the same, but it's a terribly different system. It's a bit like electing a pop star, really. And it's all about money, and it's, as you say, ramshackle and whatever. But it also, in a parliamentary system, right now the press keeps saying that Anthony Albanese is going to run an election campaign where he's a bit like Joe Biden, and he sort of hides away so that it'll just slip in. And you can't do that in a parliamentary system. I mean, even today in Western Australia, Anthony Albanese was standing with the Premier of South Australia, and an individual, Western Australia, an individual came out to the into the press conference and wanted to ask a question, and he was totally caught, and he said, "I'm not going to answer it. This is not right. It's only for the press." Blah blah blah. You can't get away with that sort of thing in a parliamentary system. People watching that would say, "Well, why can't he ask a question? Why can't we ask a question?" Whereas the American style, the presidency is all staged, and I imagine their Congress and the Senate is a different kind of battleground.
One of the things that I went onto the floor of Congress on. Immediately after they passed this resolution on the 12th of September 2001 to meet the senators and the House of Representatives, the two things that struck me was the age, they were all much older, and how few women there were.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, if you think women are underrepresented in our parliament, they're massively overrepresented compared with in Congress. And the age, too, I mean, heavens above. No wonder they have a president.
I've got nothing against 78-year-old people. I might remember that
word. You better not.
Okay, so we've got time for two final questions. There's one here, one there. Okay.
Thank you and good evening.
No setup. Oh, sorry.
Just a quick question, Mr. Howard. If we do see a change of government...
I beg your pardon?
Oh, can you hear me now?
No, I speak again.
Okay, sorry. If we do see a change of government and the potential for influence from the Greens and the far left, how do you think the ALP will look at our relationship in AUKUS? Will that diminish our role with, you know, traditional, very big, strong conservative countries like the United States and Great Britain? Will they look at us differently if we swing left and we swing green?
Well, I'm not looking for a change of government, as you know, and I will... do my level best to help it not come about. I can only take the Labor Party on its word. It says it supports AUKUS. I have my doubts, given its past track record. There was a long streak of anti-Americanism in sections of the left of the Labor Party, and I suppose the one time in my living memory that the post-ANZUS across the party support for the American alliance was put under strain was probably around 1972-73, when the Whitlam government objected very strongly to the resumption of American bombing of North Vietnam, and some of the things that were said by left-wing ministers of the then Labor government, by people like Clyde Cameron, Jim Cairns, and the like, were quite extraordinary. Now, I'm not claiming that Anthony Albanese was one of those who made those remarks, because he didn't come into Parliament until 1996, but certainly that kidney of the Labor Party, with which he was closely associated in his early years, did have that streak of anti-Americanism, and therefore you have to discount some of the comments that are now made by him when he's a born-again Curtinite believer in the American alliance.
When you went through the names of all the Liberals from the late 60s and early 70s, of course Senator Guilfoyle came from Victoria, but the names you mentioned, Staley, Fraser, Gorton, Harold Holt, all those people were from Victoria. The Liberal Party, or Victoria, used to be called the jewel in the Liberal Party crown. In New South Wales, all we had was, until you came along, perhaps was Bill McMahon. What happened to the Liberal Party in Victoria? And dare I say, was it some of the pre-selections between the wets and the dries that, to some extent, killed off the Liberal Party in Victoria? Or were there other reasons?
Well, I think the Liberal Party, federally in Victoria in the time I was in Parliament, produced quite outstanding people. I thought Peter Costello, for example, was the best Treasurer Australia's had. And it has to be said that he not only served longer in that job, but, of course, he and Alexander Downer and I occupied our respective positions the whole 12 years of our government. It's the only time since Federation that you've had the same person as Prime Minister, Prime Minister, Treasurer. The two Kemp brothers. I thought Peter Reith showed remarkable courage in taking on the maritime unions. I mean, we had been screaming for something to be done about the waterfront, and he came along and actually did something with the great help of Chris Corrigan. So I don't think something bad happened to the Liberal Party in Victoria. I think Victoria is politically a different state. I think that's got something to do with the enduring impact of the split on the Labor Party and on politics. And I'm intrigued, all this talk about federal intervention in the affairs of state branches. I tell you what, if in the 1950s the Labor Party had had the same federal-state structure that the Liberal Party has, the split would never have occurred, because the federal executive of the Labor Party, if it had our system, would never have had the power to sack the Victorian branch. That's a very complicated argument, but I think it's a valid one. So I'm not... Different parts of Australia are different politically. One of the things we should understand, and that's no bad thing. I found as Prime Minister on some issues, there was a difference between the attitude of Queenslanders and Victorians. It always has been for a long time. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's one of the advantages of the Federation.
Final comment from Anne. I knew Margaret Guilfoyle. You knew Margaret Guilfoyle. John Howard knew Margaret Guilfoyle extremely well. So what about her legacy? And why is it that she doesn't seem to have had many public arguments with anyone? I mean, was she just a nice person, or was she just polite, or did she disguise her strong positions? Why didn't she have any arguments? So we'll finish up with Anne, and then we'll go to John Howard, and that's it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think she was one to avoid an argument after avoiding the spat over the federal presidency with Malcolm Fraser. I mean, Malcolm Fraser wasn't exactly her favourite MP, but she was always loyal to him. I think it probably goes back to her Presbyterian upbringing. The idea that you stay loyal. She didn't have strong opinions, I would say, on foreign policy. I didn't find an awful lot. I didn't find anything much in the papers that suggested she had any great interest. She did travel. She did various government trips at times, but there was nothing there that came across as being of interest to her. I think she was very much the financial person. She stuck with what she knew best. She did not want to cause any kind of upset in the sense of being the one that caused any, like today we seem to have people that will come out and speak up in front of a microphone, whatever they want to say. She was very conscious that, you know, her words would have weight, and she didn't want to take a path that would in any way upset, the purpose of the Liberal Party and its work and whatever. But she spent years doing things after she retired. She was on various committees and various boards and whatever. But what I found interesting was that she did admit to changing. She did come in at the years before the 1996 election win of John Howard, and she did become part of that big exercise in the Liberal Party to encourage women to put their hands up for nominations, to pre-selections and whatever. And the famous photograph in 1996 when Howard won the election of all the women down a big line at Parliament House, the new faces that had come into Parliament because of the work that the women in the Liberal Party did. So in a way she found that she could change, but she was always one to do it without wanting to cause trouble. And that was the way she was made.
John Howard, a final reflection.
One of the great qualities I think Australians and Australian polity has always had is a sense of balance. We're not gullible, but we're not fanatics. We don't like fanatical people on either side of politics. And I thought Margaret epitomised that to a T. There was a sense of balance about her. If you had an argument in the cabinet, and there were sharply different points of view, Margaret did have a capacity. Someone would say, well, hang on, that's ridiculous and that's ridiculous. Why don't you do this? And I think she did have that sense of balance. And that was a very valuable quality.
Many thanks. So first up, I should say thanks to the late Margaret Guilfoyle, who made this terrific discussion possible. As I said, we've got copies of Anne's booklet. John Howard signed them. It was very kind of him, and that autograph's there, and Anne would be happy to do the same. So we spoke about Margaret Guilfoyle, and we learned a lot about her. But we also learned a lot about modern politics, a lot about women in politics. So we had a terrific night. So thank you, John Howard.
Pleasure.
Well done, Anne. And next time.